Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg and Carl Carlson's online. Hey, Carl.
Hey, Fred. How are you?
Hey, pretty good. I'm a little concerned, I guess would be the right word. I mean, we've got great listeners, and we're getting feedback, which is really encouraging. And people are, you know, are commenting and saying good things about the program, which is great. But I also got three questions this week, and they were all kind of lined up about the same way. And the gist was, we need to improve our product's reliability. And one was improve their plant reliability. And the questions revolved around, well, what testing should I do? What test equipment do I need? How do I deal with this with limited samples? Were the gist of the three different questions. And I can help with those specific questions, but they seemed out of context for their larger purpose, which was improving reliability. I mean, how do you approach something like that?
Oh, this is a really great topic. Let's expand this one out, because I've been almost like a life challenge to a lifelong challenge to shift from reactive to proactive in reliability methods. And I consider testing more reactive. In other words, you've got your requirements and you have a design concept and you're going to be sure that it's correct. And so I look at testing as necessary, has to be done, but it's still not proactive. You're not improving the design before the testing. You're only improving the design basically after the testing. So yeah, great subject. And if I was we can both talk about what is the essence of design for reliability. In other words, what is it, if you distill it down and keep distilling it, what is the scope of design for reliability in the design side?
I hope it's not Jell-O.
Yeah. When you get it, when you're still all done, it's just a little blob of Jell-O.
Yes. That's right. Well, part of it is that I think there's too many areas of the industries and areas of just common practice that the reliability engineers are basically test jockeys. They're coordinating testing, they're doing life testing, they're working with vendors to interpret test data. It's a function that needs to be done, yet that's not reliability engineering in my mind. And I think that's what you're getting at.
This is a scope question, because a lot of people consider assurance part of reliability engineering. And so when I first developed a DFR class, I had a project where I developed a DFR class for Six Sigma black belts, mm-hmm. because there's an overlap between design for Six Sigma and design for reliability. And so they wanted someone to come in and teach DFR to their Six Sigma right. people, and did a lot of research back and forth with them as to what it is. And it came up with a really good class. And then other people have taken that basic material and said, well, it doesn't include what about reliability growth, and what about testing, and what about this, and what about that?
Yeah, the demonstration test question.
Demonstration tests, and so DFR can. Some people consider DFR the entire subject of reliability, from concept through to end of life. Others consider DFR a portion of the body of knowledge of reliability that influences the design, and so it's really a topic of scope.
Yeah. To me, I mean, you can use the three-letter acronym however you want, as long as you're clear about what scope you're talking about it. And I've told this story many times. I initially started working in industry coming out of the military and as a manufacturing engineer and a plant supervisor and then a manufacturing engineer. And I very quickly realized that in manufacturing, we can only make the product worse. We add variability. And if the design is robust and solid and easy to manufacture, I can make a reliable product. If the design is not reliable inherently, there's no amount of manufacturing skill we can use to make it better. If it's a bad design, it's the wrong material set, it's the wrong application. And so I became convinced that it's always the design's fault.
Oh, I've been there. Yeah, silo management.
That's right. But I think it's very much the same kind of focus in all of my reliability engineering work is to focus on the decision-making of the design team. And that those decisions are then, and to a large extent, they have to be enabled. I don't know. I haven't met a designer yet that doesn't care about reliability. They want their product to work. Oftentimes, though, they're missing the information and engineering evidence, essentially, that says this is good practice, this isn't good practice. So things like stress strength calculations, derating calculations, but also all of those other trade-offs. Do I go a little bit thin here, which will decrease its ability to withstand vibration or wear in order to save a few dollars, or do I use this manufacturing process, which is less expensive, but it's not as rigid or it's not as stable or whatever? And they can calculate the cost, for example, today, right? And they may even know the process capability, saying it's possible to do that process to that specification, but they don't. Oftentimes, they just don't have a good bit of information about, well, what's the expected failure rate? What's the impact on its durability and the cost of that durability? Oftentimes, it's just the cost of failures that's missing, and you can pull those things together. But reliability happens, in my mind, at those decisions.
It does. It does. When I took over GM's reliability group in 1989, the reliability engineers back then, their entire job was informing the rest of the organization, particularly the design groups, their reliability number.
Oh, and 42. That's a good number.
You have 42. So, and go about good luck, and let me know if you need any help, and they move on somewhere else. And so it took me a number of years to shift the focus to reliability and design. And the concept I got, and I actually organized the group this way, is to train reliability engineers to sit with their counterpart in the design groups. And in other words, we set up a matrix type organization. So we'd have a chassis reliability engineer, an electrical reliability engineer, and they would co-locate and work right with the design team. So if they were focused on a Corvette program, they would work on the chassis of the Corvette, and they would almost on a daily basis have contact and interaction with the design engineers and advise and talk with them and collaborate on how to achieve reliability in design. So that sharing of information to me was part of the equation. Now that's the softer skills of consulting.
But it's also part of, it's not just being present and saying, no, that won't work. No, that won't work. I think there's two aspects to that. One of them is it's essentially doing an FMEA as you go, identifying risks, doing the experiments to explore it, you know, prioritizing. The reliability engineer can bring an extra pair of eyes, but also a pair of hands to actually go get stuff done. You know, and then a
good team member.
That's right. And then the other part is just that I think Ed, my counterpart in the electrical engineering team that I work with, he'd just sigh when he saw me walking in his office. And I said, what's the matter, Ed? And he goes, every time you show up, you tell me how my product is not going to work.
Yeah.
It's just, you know.
Well, I guess that's part of a lesson learned for us, because if we understand key characteristics, for example, and we've had some good SOR recordings speaking of reliability on key characteristics. Then we can speak in the language of how they achieve reliability, not just in what can go wrong.
That's right.
So there is the counterpart to it. Let me just tick off, Fred, some of the tools that I think are within the basket of design for reliability, and then I'd love to hear your concurrence or modification or additions. I'm thinking key characteristics, you know, the product characteristics and process characteristics. Understanding those mm-hmm. are very important to achieving reliability in design. I'll call it design guidelines. Having good design guidelines, which then include reliable designs, the design reviews, being involved with a design, ongoing design review, not the design review that's at a gate.
Right, I'm not the big slideshow fest with pizza.
Yeah. I'm talking about the one that's where you just go up to the wall and you put up some drawings and people gather around.
Yep.
So that type of design review, I think, is very much in the bailiwick of design for reliability. Another tool is design margin analysis. I think FMEA is understanding failure mechanisms. I wouldn't characterize that as a tool so much as the body of knowledge of understanding the physics of how things fail.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's design for manufacturing, design for assembly, error proofing. And then the last one I would mention is robust design. That's just off the top of my head of tools that if we were to say, what are the tools that most impact design for reliability? Those are the ones that come to mind. How about from your end?
Well, yeah, a lot of overlap. So I think you overlap with the robust design and the margin analysis into the SPC statistics, design of experiments, optimization, that realm. I think we used to teach a seminar for engineers at HP that it had a big section on reliability statistics. It was, what are the metrics? How do you interpret them? How do you use them? How do you get the right information from vendors, from suppliers, from your own processes? Just the techniques of measuring reliability and estimating it throughout the design process, so that there was a common understanding with the statistical language in it. The other one, a lot of overlap. I'm trying to think, when you were talking about failure mechanisms and understanding it, that comes into play in, you know, what could go wrong. Mm-hmm. But I think it also could expand out into the physics of failure. It's the modeling saying, well, here's the trade-off.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it again overlaps into the statistics realm there and experimental realm. But one part I think that's missing from this is the environmental and use profiles.
Yes.
The influence. We used to have we called it an environmental test manual, but it included the, like for automobiles, it would be North America, or I maybe it's even segmented smaller than that, but it would be what's the high temperatures, what's the low temperature, and what's the distribution of temperatures,
mm-hmm.
right? Not everybody has to have a car that starts at minus 50 degrees C every day of the year. Even people in North Dakota don't. They get above minus 50 once in a while, right? So if you design it to start every single day, day after day, and every start is at minus 40, it may not be an optimized for somebody starting at 70 degrees C,
right?
Which is going to happen way more often.
Right.
And so it was providing not just the weather distributions, but we also worked with the marketing teams to say, well, how often are they going to push this button? How often are they going to use this? Where's it going to be stored? What kind of ventilation's around it? What's it? And on and on and on about the day in the life for the different market segments. And that became a document that went to the design team before the design started. And the other part would be lessons learned. Our history. What did we do mm-hmm. in the last product? What worked, didn't work? Some of the failure analysis type stuff, the big gotchas that we need to never forget. Some design teams do a great job at doing that. Others, I call it legends and lore. They kind of, the gray beards have to carry it forward. There are, so I would say the statistics I would add to your list, the environmental understanding of the environment and use conditions, and lessons learned.
Beautiful. This is a good list. And what you said early on, I completely agree with, which is all of these help making decisions. And so if we can help design decisions, which is different than gate decisions, there's a lot of tools that can help gate decisions. But if we can help the decisions of good designs, reliable designs, then I think that's really the primary emphasis of design for reliability. Let me just share with you a story that came to mind on failure mechanisms. Years back when I was managing a large reliability group, I decided to abandon the typical group meetings where we'd sit around for an hour and talk about administrative things, you know, how can we use less paper or whatever, and talk about failure mechanisms. So I assigned, we had a group of about 20 then. I assigned each person a different category of failure mechanism and had them go out and research it and bring back, and at least half of that group meeting, instead of the usual administrative stuff, was a presentation and a discussion around a given failure mechanism. And just to raise the body of knowledge of that group
on how
things can fail. And that worked out really well because it opened up all kinds of doors into how we can improve designs and make them more robust. It was a fun.
Well, it also increases awareness so that if you see a design or you see a concept being put forward, you can go, well, have you thought about creep? Have you thought about this? What's the margin on that? It's not necessarily for failure analysis, where it also becomes very, very key, or test development, but it's that level of knowledge that many of us gain through testing and through failure analysis studies that needs to be pushed way forward in the design process. And if you can quantify or have a good understanding of, say, corrosion rates, that can be a useful information for a design team looking at, well, what coatings do we need or what materials are we going to use? And that's well before you build any prototypes. So
very good. The earlier the better in terms of design for reliability, because when you influence good designs, and this is the essence, by the way, of design review based on failure mode, which is another subject, but good designs is what you start with. And the essence of good designs, you have to be working with that design team to select the right designs. So there's tools like concept FMEA or concept selection or trade-off studies or different types of analyses, decision matrix, which is like a Pew analysis, that are all with the idea of making good designs right from the get-go. The first paper I ever wrote, this another thing that comes to mind here, was in the early 1990s. The first paper I ever wrote and submitted to a conference was to an international maintenance conference on the subject of the essentially designing for maintainability and reliability.
Right.
And I outlined what I talked about the wrong way for product development, which is you have requirements and then you design a product and then you go into lengthy test and fix until you get it where you need to be, or you just launch.
Microsoft model, I call it.
Yeah, right. Versus what I call the right way, which is requirements well defined and then working on design improvements. In other words, design for reliability. Then verification or validation becomes more of just that. It's not the long test and fix process.
Right.
So that kind of introduced it, and that's the way I tried to implement my reliability work for the rest of my career.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to say there's probably another episode here because I've been hearing more and more about agile design. It's coming out of the software world, agile development, but it's exploring, and you touched on it. I think you're probably on that idea. Is in the early concept phases, have 5-6 different concepts developed out enough that you can ferret out where the big challenges are for not just reliability, it's for all of the aspects of creating a good design, and then select rather than pick one and force it to work.
It's amazing, Fred, how those, and every company's different on this, but that process can be very fast or very slow in companies. And sometimes those decisions are made without, I'll even say oftentimes they're made without reliability input. Mm-hmm. It takes a while to get a place at the table to where your input is considered for the different concepts in order to select the right one. You have to have credibility and good soft skills to get that place at the table.
Yeah, it's a subject for dozens of more episodes. we've been doing a lot more on Ascendo around soft skills because there's just more and more emphasis on it. And you touched on it earlier is with your design team and they have to be technically competent, familiar with a wide range of failure mechanisms and statistics and material science. And that list keeps growing the earlier in the process we get involved. But I think equally as important is the soft skills of working individually with people, working with groups, doing presentations, presenting results, presenting proposals. Those are all skills that engineers typically don't have.
Absolutely correct. I think they're essential. You can't do one without the other. I mean, you can. There are people that do a really good job, and they perform a great role. So I should modify that. Working only on the hard skills. Mm-hmm. So they're great at calculations and analyses, and you need that work. But if you're going to move up in career beyond that, then you have to get good at the soft skills. I don't, however, think I would want to be good at soft skills only without having an understanding of the underlying engineering principles and what we're characterizing as hard skills.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. Yeah. Well, I think we're going to go off the deep end here with another episode if we do that. I think it is important, and even though it was kind of the last thing we mentioned, we talked about a lot of technically hard skills, yet it's all part of being intimate's probably not the right word, but being very close and effective in the small teams that you work with. And sometimes individuals that you're working with. So building rapport and credibility and stuff all enable all of the hard skills to come through and to be effective. So yes. I think it is very, very important. And especially when it's not, because it's easy, it's a completely different role for us if we take a prototype, go down to the lab and run Halt, for example. And yet soft skills still come into play if you want the team to understand what the failures are and what actions should be taken. How do we improve this and understand it? So I don't think we can get away from soft skills. I think there's types of scopes that we have that minimize it and it's comfortable. And, you know, that might be part of why so many people this week were asking me questions about how do I do better testing?
Might be. Just summarizing back to this subject, I would suggest to listeners to work on expanding your knowledge of the design for reliability tools and methods that Fred and I have been talking about today. You can always get better at them, and every company is trying to do a better job at designing for reliability. And as you can become a better advocate and better support for those types of tools, better processes for key characteristics, better, you know, all the different things that we talked about, you'll get known and become the go-to person for designing for reliability. And I think that's a very positive for anybody's career in reliability.
That's right. Very true. Good summary, Carl. I think we'll leave it there. And so for the audience, you know, you've heard the type of questions we were getting. And then Carl, your experience a little bit around the scope, various people have different scope definitions for what is design for reliability. I think you and I agree that it's influencing those decisions that are done day to day by every designer on your team, and influencing those and including reliability in those decisions is appropriately weighted for your particular program is the essence of design for reliability. So as a listener, you know, how are you doing design for reliability as Carl and I were just describing it, or are you trying to break into that? And we know that there's barriers to get a seat at the table to be effective earlier in a program. So if you're struggling, let us know. We'd love to hear what kind of challenges you're facing. We could certainly be a subject for another program. And then also, if you've been successful, what's worked? What were the key things that made a difference that made your Design for Reliability program very effective? And we'd love to share the success stories of that also. So let us know. I should mention that go to reliability.fm and you can find Speaking of Reliability and the other shows in the podcast network, plus plenty of opportunities for leaving comments or feedback for us, or just you can find us on the About pages and you can send us comments or suggestions or stories directly. And like I said, we'd certainly love to hear from you. So with that, Carl, let's wrap this one up.
Sounds good, Fred. Good topic.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett of Apex Ridge Reliability. I want to invite you to take a look and get a copy of 50 Ways to Improve Product Reliability. It's a reliability book created for a broad audience on how to incorporate reliability tools and methods in the product development program. To get a copy, go to ascendoreliability.com/go/50ways. That's 50WAYS.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.